Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everybody. Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome to you. Welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us at home from wherever you are. I'd like to start class by asking you to talk to each other in service of this being a place where you get to know other meditators and make some connections. And I'm going to talk tonight about a few different things, but one of the main themes I've been reflecting on today is what the Buddha calls becoming, and this tendency of our mind to have the delusion that we'll be happy when we get somewhere else, when we become something else, that there's a destination. And I'll talk about it, but of course, there in Buddhism, there is a destination. Nirvana, the third noble truth, is the desired destination, enlightenment, wisdom, compassion. We are trying to develop that, uncover that, experience that. But so often our minds say, I'll be happy when something other than wisdom, some sensual or material or some attainment, physical, material attainment. So for the small groups, as you reflect on your own tendencies and mind, what is it that your mind tells you will make you happy? What are some of the stories that your mind tells you currently or has in the past? It's always interesting to reflect on sort of where we are now and remembering when we used to think like, man, if I could just get, and then you got it. If I could get that career, or if I could get that relationship, or if I could get that meditation practice going, or if I could get sober, or whatever it is. And it's like, okay, now I'm sober and I have the career and I have the meditation practice and I still hate everybody. It didn't work. or maybe it did on some levels. I mean, hopefully it has on some levels, but not ultimate satisfaction, not ultimate peace as the outcome of getting what we want. If what we want is anything other than liberation, other than wisdom. So small groups to admit to each other some of the delusions you hold about getting what you want, and then we'll meditate and we'll talk about that tonight. So at home, I'll put you in breakout rooms and in the room. Try to talk to people you don't know. Try to keep it to about a minute each. Keep it short. So much of our suffering is created through self-centeredness, the feelings of I and me and mine. I want, I need, I have to have, I need to get rid of. The good news is it's not your fault. The mind does that all by itself. You're not, self-centeredness is not a defect of character. It's not a sin. It's not your fault. It's just how the human mind is wired, just a survival instinct. But with wisdom, with some investigation, some mindfulness, some introspection, we start to see more and more clearly how much of our unhappiness is unnecessary. How we don't have to obey the self-centered tendencies of the human condition. And this is central to the Buddha's teachings. It's part of the awakening, part of the unpacking that happens through observation, investigation, and start the process of becoming less disidentified, not so. We still have a self-centered mind. It's just, I don't think wisdom gets rid of it, but our relationship to it changes. We see it more clearly. So it's very central to the Buddha's teachings, to what we're trying to do a necessary part of ending the suffering that we can end in life. This is the Buddha's teaching. One of the simple practices that I've been employing in my own life, my own practice for many decades, it's been taught by a few different, Thich Nhat Hanh has a version of it, this nun Ayakema has a version of it, of simply in meditation, in life, and saying to yourself, and I'll use it in the meditation, but I want to give it to you as a setup, reminding yourself there's nowhere to go. That tendency to think I need to get somewhere else. I need to go. Happiness is out there. Peace is out there. It's a somewhere else. And there's that reflecting of here. All of the wisdom that I am seeking is here in my own heart and mind. And I don't got to go somewhere for it. I just need to look for it here. Now. Nowhere to go. Nothing to do. That feeling of I always have to do, I have to earn, I have to attain, I need to do something. Part of our practice is learning non-doing. Learn to sit, learn to be, learn to turn towards what's happening without reacting, without doing something about it, just being with it. Right now it's like this, nothing to do. I mean, I will later talk about, I have some critique of nothing to do, because we are, even meditation is something that we're doing. Even responding wisely is something that we're doing. But it is interesting to put that thought, nothing, nowhere to go and nothing to do, to cut through that tendency of becoming, of always leaning forward, always looking outside of ourselves, thinking I have to do something, I have to go somewhere. And the last part of that is no one to be. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, no one to be. And just bringing that into your mind, bringing that into your heart, bringing that, I'll bring it into the instructions a little bit tonight, but as a, you know, kind of setup, reflecting on, what if I let go of being Noah? Let go of being I, me, mine. And I didn't have to put on the mask of selfing, I-ing, me-ing, mining. I don't have to be any of that. I can, no one, no identity, nothing that I need to defend, nothing that I need to project, nothing that I need to protect. I don't need to be inflated or deflated. I don't need to, no one to be. This idea of becoming someone else, something else, even spiritual, even wise. I don't even have to be that. No one to be. So we'll meditate on these in this direction. Finding a way to sit that's upright, that's relaxed. A posture that feels sustainable. Relaxing into the upright posture. Eyes gently closed, releasing any tension that you can release, softening the belly, the shoulders, the jaw, brow, any places in your body where you hold tension. As you exhale, soften, release. And with all meditation practice, I feel it's useful to begin by setting the intention to be kind, to be patient, to be accepting of our experience, Even these nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be can become another task, trying so hard to be nobody, to do nothing. A relaxed awareness is enough. Present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness in the body. Bringing awareness to the sensations. This body feels all by itself. Bringing awareness to the breath. This body breathes all by itself. Even that thought of I am breathing is only true on the relative level. Ultimately, the body is breathing you. The body breathes all by itself. The body feels all by itself, nervous system doing its job. Spending a few minutes collecting the attention, focusing on the sensation of the breath, letting the sounds, smells, tastes, thoughts, emotions recede to the background, giving our full attention to the sensations created by the body breathing. Simple, focused awareness. Body breathing all by itself, and awareness knowing the breath all by itself. Sensations arise, pass, awareness knows, receives. The thought, the feeling, I am breathing, I am aware. Although true on the relative level, is extra, is an unnecessary construct, a convenient fiction. Trying to get a sense of less doing meditation and more just receiving. Kind awareness, receiving sensation. Breath comes and goes, thoughts arise and pass, and sometimes the attention is drawn back into thinking. Awareness of thinking, planning, remembering. You can choose to return to the breath, or you can begin to expand, be open. Be inclusive. Sounds, smells, tastes, sensations, emotions, thoughts are all occurring. Rising and passing through awareness. When you become aware of a thought, rather than the identification of I'm thinking, I'm planning, I'm worrying, I'm resenting, fantasizing, whatever the mind is doing, depersonalize it a bit in your practice if you can. Rather than I am thinking, the mind is thinking all by itself. Plans are passing through awareness. Memories are passing through awareness. when aware of pleasant or unpleasant experience, just acknowledging it. Pain is present or pleasure is present. Comfort, discomfort, joy, sorrow. But if you don't do anything about it, just accept it, just be with it. Pain often has a message of you should do something, you're uncomfortable, you should do something about it. Learning to just be with pain. Likewise, pleasure often has a message. You should do something about this. You should get more of it. You should hold on to it. You should try to keep it. Increase it. Soften into what's happening. Relax around any tension, resistance. Can experiment with repeating the phrases in your heart, mind. Nowhere to go. Nothing to do. No one to be. Perhaps replacing the thoughts your mind creates about the future, about being, becoming, our plans, our hopes. Nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be. Over and over. All of the wisdom that we seek is right here in this present. source of happiness is right here. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to do. There's no one to be. There's nothing worth clinging to or identifying with as I, me, or mine. Nothing worth suffering about. The self is a convenient fiction, I, me, mine. And we can use that in our meditation, like in the loving kindness, we say, may I be happy. May I be at ease. May I be free from suffering. Not clinging or overly identifying with the I, but using it as a convenient way to think, to communicate. This heart, this mind, this body, this awareness that we call I or me. Extending some loving kindness to this unfolding process of sensation and emotion and thought that your awareness is experiencing. May I be happy. May I be at ease. May I be free from suffering. And extending this wish to each other. May you be happy. May you be at ease. May you do what needs to be done to free yourself from suffering. Extending this attitude of goodwill, well-wishing, kindness, out in all directions, sharing it with all beings in existence. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at ease. May all beings do what needs to be done to get as free as possible. Becoming sort of a strange concept, kind of not something we normally talk about or think about outside of this context. But pointing to something that we all experience, that just part of humanness, that tendency of the mind to seek happiness outside of ourselves, and the idea that there is some, I'll be happy when I get there, when I get what I want, when I become what I think I need to be happy, to be at peace, to be satisfied, looking for satisfaction in a destination. Rather than, and the main problem with this seems to be that we choose destinations that don't work. Because I don't know, I there's some forms of Buddhism that talk about like there's, you know, kind of there's no destination, like you're already enlightened. You just need to realize it. But that realizing it is a destination. Realization is going from over here where I don't have wisdom. It's a journey. It is a journey, and there is a process and to developing true wisdom and getting from, you know, the first noble truth of awareness of our suffering and the second noble truth of awareness of the causes of our suffering to the third noble truth of, you know, actually realizing non-suffering, experiencing freedom from suffering. It's a journey. It's a destination. Nirvana is the goal. Enlightenment, freedom. Maybe, you know, we can kind of have our Western harm reductionist view of Buddhism, which is like kind of decreasing suffering rather than total abstinence from suffering. That's okay if you have that kind of, if you don't have hope for total liberation, that's okay. But just a goal of decreasing suffering, increasing liberation. Progress rather than perfection, as they say. It's okay, it's a good way to think about it. Buddhism is a perfection model. It does promise that you can be perfectly enlightened in this lifetime. You can experience zero if you practice diligently and thoroughly, and that you can experience zero suffering. That is the Buddha's teaching. That is what Buddhism believes. Not zero pain, not zero unpleasant thoughts, not zero self-centered mentality, just zero identification with it and zero resistance to the pain and zero attachment to pleasure. So it's really important, you know, kind of distinction, because sometimes when we say no more suffering, we think I'm going to be comfortable forever. Zero. There's nowhere in Buddhism that it promises comfort. But because we tend to equate pain with suffering, it's a really radical perspective that says, no, you'll still have pain. But you won't have to suffer about it if you develop wisdom, compassion in relationship to the pain. You still have a mind that plans and worries and gives you bad advice, that has that becoming tendency, that sort of like, I'm going to be so happy when I get there. And until I get there, I'm just going to worry about not getting there. And I'm going to crave to be there, wherever there is. And it's, you know, important to identify what those stories are that our mind is making up about where we think we need to get to, who we need to become. Whatever the story is for you, when I write the book, when I make the movie, when I get the degree, when I get the job, when I get the promotion, when I get the marriage, when I get out of the marriage, when I'll be so happy. When I have the kids, when the kids get the fuck out of the house, when I go to the retreat, when this fucking retreat's over, when I go to meditation. So interesting how often, if we reflect on that which I really wanted, and then I got it, and I'm like, I really wanted to go to this retreat, and I'm in the middle of this retreat, and I'm like, how many more days? Why did I think this was a good idea? I really wanted to, you know, whatever it is that we really want, even sometimes when they're wholesome things like meditation, retreats, still in the midst of it, like I really wanted to, that idea of like, oh, being a parent's gonna be amazing. And then being a parent, like, oh, this is really fucking hard. Parenting is really hard. How many more years? The rest of my life? It's fucking expensive. In the teachings on, so this happens all by itself. The I making tendency, I was looking at this thing from Bhikkhu, Buddha Dasa Bhikkhu, and he says it in a concise way, and he frames it as, I'll share it with you, he says, I and mine. He said, there's a spiritual disease, and how it is how a single handful of the Dharma can cure it. So he talks about, before this section, he talks about how the Buddha is the great physician. And the medic, and for the disease of suffering that we all experience, and that the Dharma, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, in the Theravada, they don't put the R, it's Dhamma. He says, in the Dhamma, just a handful of it is the medication. And that if we take this medication, it will cure the disease of suffering. Spiritual disease is the disease whose germs lie in the feeling of we and ours, of I and mind, that is regularly present in the mind. The germ that is already in the mind develops first into the feeling of I and mind, and then, acting through the influence of self-centeredness, becomes greed, hatred, and delusion, causing trouble for both oneself and others. That self-centeredness that not only makes our lives more difficult, more troublesome for ourselves, but also then we annoy each other. We, you know, cause trouble for each other, for everyone that has to deal with our self-centeredness. And I really, one of the things I so much appreciate about Buddhism is how it normalizes rather than judges, rather than assigns judgment. The germs of it are already in us. We're born into self-centeredness. It's not your fault. Now that it's been diagnosed, now that we've become aware of it, now that we see it, start to see it, because I don't know about you, but for me, and I feel like for most people, we wander through life not knowing what to do about it, thinking it's our fault, or, you know, religions or traditions or even some of the psychological that put so much blame, so much kind of, and there's no blame in Buddhism. There's no shame in Buddhism. The germs are already there. You're born with it. Causing trouble for both oneself and others. These are the symptoms of the spiritual disease that lies within us. To remember it easily, you can call it the disease of I and mine. Every one of us has the disease of I and mine. We absorb more germs every time we see a form, hear a sound, smell an odor, touch an tangible object, taste a flavor, or think in the manner of an ignorant person, which is kind of all the time. Ignorant is not a pejorative term in Buddhism. It's just everybody who's not enlightened is ignorant. That's us. We're constantly thinking in an ignorant manner, taking it personal, that which is not actually personal. And this list of the sense doors, he might go into this. This is the description of dependent origination, the 12 links of dependent origination, which is that because of the ignorant state of mind that we're all in, the lack of wisdom, the lack of seeing clearly, the lack of an enlightened view of things, immediately when the sense doors make contact, sense contact, there's consciousness and then there's sense contact, when you're seeing, immediately the mind says, I see, I smell, I taste. It adds the self, the I, the first person narrative to everything, rather than just seeing, smelling, tasting, feeling. There is the I, me, mine that, you know, so he's pointing to like that, you know, that's a more germs, more disease, more self-centered, personalizing that which is not personal. It's just the body is seeing. That's what the body does. Like in the meditation tonight, that shift from I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out, to just shifting to awareness is receiving the body that breathes all by itself. Where's the I? Where's the me? There's just a sensation. We have some influence over our breath, but we're not really in control of it. It's happening all by itself. Just like the heart beats all by itself, and the digestive system works all by itself, and the nervous system works all by itself, and the mind thinks all by itself. And the mind creates the I all by itself. So, such a different understanding to bring that into relating to this human condition, this being. In other words, we receive the germs from those surrounding things that infect us and cause the disease every time there is a sense contact. That's what I was explaining. Every time they're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, the mind personalizes it. I, me, mine. We must recognize this germ, which is clinging, and see that it is of two kinds: attachment to I and attachment to mine. Attachment to I is the feeling that I is a special entity, that I am like this or like that, that I am the greatest or something of that sort. Mine is taking something as belonging to me, that which I love, that which I like. Even that which we hate is regarded as my enemy. This is called mine. Isn't that interesting how we even take ownership of that which we hate? My enemy belongs to me, my opposition, my haters. They're mine. I own them. I own all of my enemies. They're my enemies. You have your own enemies. You can't have mine. Don't touch my enemies. In the Pali language, I is Atta and mine is Atta Nya, Nyaya. I don't know. As an alternative, we may use the terms generally used in Indian philosophy. The word ahamakara, I-ing, means having or making the feeling of I, and it stems from the word aham, I, the word for, I don't know these words, mamamakara. There's a lot of mamas in there. Mamamakara, meaning Maying, kind of creating the Maying. Iing and Maying. Having or making the feeling of mine, and it stems from the words mama, mine. The feelings of Iing and Maying are so dangerous and poisonous that we call them the spiritual disease. Every branch of philosophy and of Dhamma in the Buddha's time wanted to wipe them out. Even the followers of other creeds had the same aim of wiping out the I-ing and the my-ing. The difference between other creeds and Buddhism is that when they eradicated those feelings, they called what remained the true self, pure Atman, the person that there was a kind of identification with, the consciousness that sees through the I and me and mine. Buddhism refused to see these names, use these names, because it didn't want to cause any new attachment to self or things belonging to a self, rather than an identification with I am the true self that is aware of the impersonal nature of I, me, and mine. The Buddha used anatta, not self, and that even the I tendency of the mind is not self, the body is not self, the emotions are not self. Almost done. The state free of I-ing and my-ing is considered simply to be voidness. This voidness is called nibbana, as in the phrase, nibbana is the supreme voidness. Nibbana and absolute is absolutely void of I and mine in every possible respect, without any remainder. Such is nibbana, the end of the spiritual disease. This matter of I or mine is very hard to see. If you don't take a genuine interest in it, you won't be able to understand that it is the force behind all suffering, the power behind the spiritual disease. If you don't take an interest, if we don't really get curious and interest and investigate and try to unpack the self-centered tendency of the human condition, we won't be able to end suffering. I think I spend a lot of time in my own practice and in my teachings encouraging developing the skills of non-attachment and the skills of compassion. And many of you who've listened to me for a long time know that I think we can simply break Buddhism down and the kind of the goal, the practice, into these three skills: non-attachment, compassion, and non-self, non-identification, in order to end greed, hatred, and delusion. But I don't spend it as much time because it's hard to talk about. It's weird to talk about. It's clunky. I, me, mine, selfing, mying, mama, comma. But it's key to the transformation that we're trying to experience. And this tendency of the mind to think that there's a destination other than wisdom, I feel fine with Nirvana, Nibbana as the destination, wisdom, more wisdom as I'm seeking wisdom. I feel like I've been on a quest for decades that I am trying to get from ignorance to wisdom. So the nowhere to go, I have, I like it. I like the way it cuts through some of the doing, some of the selfing. I like nowhere to go and nothing to do and no one to be. I like reflect on that. But I also feel like actually there's very much a path unfolding here. And I am doing, even meditating, I feel like I don't know about, the I is the convenient fiction of, but awareness is effort is being put into being aware and being awake and being present with the experience of the mind and the body in a way that will mitigate suffering. How do I respond wisely? Is the question, has been the question, continues to, will continue to be the question until wisdom becomes natural, our nature, till we're really awake to it. I do feel like it's important, and maybe I should have led with this, but of course, I said it a couple times in the meditation, but there's the difference between the relative and the ultimate. This not self is an ultimate reality, ultimate teaching. But on the relative level, we have plans, we have goals, we want to become someone and something, and we want to do some, hopefully, some positive shit with our lives. On the relative level, and also on the relative level, like, you are a self. You're you, and I'm me on the relative level, and boundaries are important. Right? And being, aware of your actions and yourself and your thoughts and your emotions and your personal space and how you're attuned to others, all of that stuff on the relative level is so important. And so we've got to be careful of going to the ultimate non-self and non-becoming and not also having a wise way of showing up in our relationships and how we speak and how we listen and how we interact with each other, how we show up in the world. All of that is very important relative skills. Don't want to dismiss the relative identities that we are living through in this lifetime, including gender and race and age and orientation and all of those things that are true. They're not ultimately who we are, but they are relatively true in how we walk through the world and how we're treated by the world. So I don't want to dismiss any of that. I guess my sense is The mind is going to tell you, all of us, all kinds of stories about what will make us happy. Becoming, the becoming narrative. I don't think anybody's mind is going to stop doing that. But the more awareness we bring to, like, oh, this is selfing. This is becoming. Knowing that that's what the mind is doing and having some relationship to it, rather than being asleep to that tendency and believing, I'm really, it's going to work this time. I believe the narrative and I'm identified with the narrative. And when I get there, game over. I will be happy forever, because that's the sort of backup story to the ignorant mind, which is, it'll make me happy forever. Rather than reframing our experience, understanding the impermanent nature of all things, impermanence is key in all of these teachings and all of this, of realizing that actually what I'm seeking is like a peak experience. And that when you get to the peak, you don't stay there. It rises and then it falls. It rises and then it falls. And nothing wrong with seeking peak experiences, you know, make the movie, write the book, get the degree, get the relationship, do all of those things. But with the wisdom that knows it's not going to permanently satisfy the heart. It's going to be a peak experience. This was a wonderful experience. Really enjoyed it. It was very pleasant. And then it passed. It doesn't last. Impermanence. Part of the becoming is the delusion, is the confusion, thinking that there's somewhere to get to as far as material or sensual or some external place that will make us happy forever, rather than like, oh, that'll be a good experience for a little while. I've shared somewhat often about how my son, he hasn't said this in a while, but when he was younger, sometimes when he was manipulating me into buying him things, he would say, please, Dad, it'll make me happy. And he would say, and he would give a time. It'll make me happy for a week. And I just really appreciated that insight that he had into himself, into the impermanent nature of satisfaction. And it wasn't the delusion of like, I'm going to love it forever. He was like, you know, yes, I will totally put it on the shelf in 2 weeks. But for 2 weeks, I will be really excited to have it. Even though, I mean, it probably was exaggerating. It was like for 7 hours. But having that understanding of ourselves of like, yeah, the peak experience. It arises, it passes. It doesn't ultimately satisfy. And so we go through life chasing the next pleasant experience, the next attainment, getting the degree, getting the next degree, getting the job, trying to get the promotion, getting the car, getting the motorcycle, getting the shopping. Shopping. Just thinking like, what? I've got a house full of shit I don't need already, but Prime Week or whatever. Shopping's fun. I need to get some more shit that I want, but I don't need. How many motorcycles you got? Me too. The wisdom of understanding that nothing works. But go for it anyways. This is my, you know, as householders, that's sort of my attitude of like, it's not going to work, but enjoy life. You know, and if you can enjoy it with the understanding of non-attachment and the understanding of impermanence and not the disappointment and suffering from, I really thought it was going to work and it didn't work and I'm so heartbroken because it didn't work. Nothing works except for wisdom, except for non-attachment. Except for loving kindness and equanimity, and wisdom is the source of happiness. Stuff isn't the source of happiness. If we have wisdom, we can relate to our stuff with wisdom and knowing it's impermanent and replaceable and not the source of happiness. Maybe that's all my thoughts. We have a few minutes if there's questions, comments, clarifications, please.
How does one gain wisdom? Can it just be through meditating, or are there other things you should be doing as well?
So look at the, think about, in a Buddhist perspective, it's the Eightfold Path. The whole, all you need to know is the Eightfold Path. Meditation is 7 and 8. It's the key. It's the, you know, in order to experience understanding and intention and speech and action and livelihood, it all comes from the effort into mindfulness, into seeing clearly. You can intellectually get the knowledge of understanding from reading the books. But you can't get the wisdom without the meditative awareness, without the investigation. I like the way Buddhadasa said something about without that interest and that investigation, that, you know, that has to be something that we do internally and not intellectually. It's not it's not a knowledge-based. Wisdom is knowing from direct experience, not from what the book told you should know. That difference between, you know, reading a map or walking the path. Like we can, you know, oh yeah, the map looks amazing. Somebody said, you know, it's the difference between, you know, reading the menu, and you can try to eat the menu, right? But reading the menu will not fill you up. You have to eat the food, take the recipe, make the dish. Right, and so that's the Eightfold Path is not something to be believed or to be read. It's the menu, it's the map. And when you walk this path, and be careful with your speech, and you practice the 5 precepts, and careful with your actions, and you practice the 4 foundations of mindfulness, and get concentrated, the outcome is wisdom. Wisdom into the impermanent nature of all things. Wisdom into the compassionate response towards pain, the non-attached response towards pleasure, and wisdom towards this I-making mind, changing our relationship to the becoming tendency that the mind encourages and seeing through it, pulling the curtain back on the Wizard of Oz and seeing like, oh, this is just a scared little ego self giving me bad advice. Trying to keep me small, trying to keep me trapped, rather than the awareness that sees so much of what the ego suggests is not good advice, not trustworthy, that I, me, mine. Ultimately, relatively, sometimes it's quite good instinctual, you know, boundary making stuff. You know, we also want that, but it's knowing the difference. Meditation does feel like the key to developing wisdom, and but not by itself. It's also the renunciation, and the study is helpful. Listening to the Dharma talks, reading the books, downloading this information into our knowledge, like really getting clear with it, and even hearing a talk like this, and then throughout your week being like, my mind is becoming. That's becoming. I saw there was an image and I saw it and I said, I see. And then my mind says, and I want to get that. And then the mind consciously or unconsciously said, and I'll be happy when I get that. And then you track it back and be like, oh, I'm in this craving. I'm in this clinging. I'm in this big story of what will make me happy. And you track it back to what happened. The I saw an image on Instagram and clicked right through. And put in my address, and then I got this t-shirt.
Yeah.
Right? And like just instantly, kind of, there was seeing, and then there was craving, and then there was consumering, and then there was a package at my door, and there was a moment of pleasure. And then, and it'd be in a drawer with my other 500 t-shirts. Please ring.
If the goal of Buddhism is to eliminate suffering, right? I get kind of scared off by these anatta kind of things because it sounds so removed. It sounds lonely to me.
Yeah.
I'm kind of scared. But I mean, those are like extremes. I like that you said that Buddhism is a perfection model.
Yeah.
I mean, is it fair to say, or is it like lazy Western consumerist Buddhist to say that everything that isn't suffering and isn't causing suffering is okay, and that we are okay to live a full life, and the only time, I mean, all this practice that we're doing is to prepare us to not enter into that suffering or deal with it when we're there. And that leaves a huge amount of life there for us to enjoy and not enjoy, and as long as we're not suffering over it, right?
Yes, 100%. But and I would encourage you to actually. Could you hear at home? Do I need to repeat that? Let me just try to repeat it real quick. Of like, Frank was saying that some hesitance around the anatta, the not self, because there's something that seems kind of void in it, and even he used the term void. The only thing that is being subtracted is the suffering, void of, empty of, subtracting suffering. Everything else in, the whole existence, the relationships and the experience and all of life continues. The only thing that, it's that he was talking about, the disease. It's just the difference between living a healthy life or a life of being diseased with suffering, the germs and the, you take the Dharma as your medicine, and then you live your life normal, engaged, joyous, still have some pain, still have some difficulties, still have some conflicts, but no suffering about any of it. There's nothing to be afraid of. Even with the anatta, even the, and it's just, and maybe the better way to think about it is being less and less self-centered. Sounds good. I'd like to be less self-centered, more and more attuned, more and more wise, more and more connected with each other, and just not in a self-centered, fear-based mentality. Who doesn't want that? Everybody want, like, why would we not want that? I'm not speaking from direct experience, but I do believe that enlightenment is perfectly safe. And it is interesting to look at that part of the mind that thinks, oh, this might not be safe. That part of the ego that feels threatened by saying no one to be, that says, wait a minute, fuck you. I've got to be somebody. They've been telling me my whole life, I need to be somebody. I've been telling myself my whole life. And then when you put that reflection in the mind, there's the part of the ego that gets scared. I use that example of the wizard pushing the buttons of, like that scared little guy on Wizard of Oz. I'm like, fuck, if you pull back the curtain on the ego that's been Mara, that's been controlling things, it feels quite threatened. It feels like, no, hey, not safe, dude. Do not be happy. Happiness is foreign. It is threatening. It is, but it's perfectly safe. Any questions from anybody at home? A couple minutes. You can raise your hand. Okay. Maybe we'll leave it there for tonight. There's nowhere to go and there's nothing to do, but you're all invited to Sri Lanka to go and be on pilgrimage with me in November, November 10th through 24th. Some of you are here that are coming. There's a few spots left. If you're planning to come, sign up, join us for this adventure, where we'll do some retreat time, we'll do some beach time, we'll do some shopping time, we'll do a lot of becoming in the market. We'll visit some sacred ancient ruins, some sites. It'll be a good time. And part of it, you know, for me, when I think about these trips, or anybody that's thinking about coming, you know, any way that your mind is will tell you, like, oh, that's going to be fun the whole time. It's not true. Some of it will, it'll be beautiful. It'll be, you know, like, but some of it will be stressful, living with 20 or 30 other annoying humans. You know, some of it's stressful. It's, you know, the conflict that we have with each other, the bus schedule, the, you know, not getting to choose what you eat all of the time or where you sleep all of the time. And all of that is part of, like, great practice to let go of control, to let go of the selfing and the, and be like, I'm along for the ride. And I'm along with these people, some of whom I love, some of who push my buttons. And, I, you know, like, it's such a great practice to do. And there's a book that I read a long time called Hard Travels to Sacred Places. And that's how I think about traveling in Asia and going to the Buddhist country. Some of the travel is quite hard, and just going, you know, into a different 16-hour different time zone, it's challenging. But that you go to these places that are, you know, nowhere to go, but you go to these places that are considered sacred, and depends on if they are for you. What meaning you assign to the Bodhi tree, or to these ancient monasteries, or, you know, to these beautiful, one of the places in Sri Lanka that we'll visit is the Temple of the Tooth, where supposedly they have one of the Buddha's tooths, which is really fucking weird. Just a tooth, just like, whether it's even true or not, who knows? But to many people, it's like this place, like, wow, there's a sacred relic from 2,600 years ago. A tooth in that box up there. Let's bow to it. For me, I'm a little, you know, as you can tell, I'm a little sacrilegious about these things. Anyways, you're all invited. I also have a day long in the information's on againstthestream.com. I have a day long next month, I think on the 17th. You're also all invited to that. We'll do a day of sitting and walking practice. You can register for that on refugerecovery.org. I'm doing that through Refuge. Good to register to sign up. You can come in person or you can do it at home. But if you want to do that day long with me, it's here, yeah. The registration's on the Refuge site. George has an announcement about Off the Cushion. George, for the people at home that might want to join the Zoom, should we put your number in the chat or something?
Yes.
Do you want all these people to have your number?
I
don't know. Let's see.
Or if they add their name, I'll come grab them after.
If you want to be part of this Off the Cushion, there's going to be a meeting for people at home. You can add your info, put a note in the chat. We'll download the chat. We'll give it to George. He'll add you to the WhatsApp group about this Off the Cushion engagement activities for the Sangha. Mostly it's LA-based, but maybe there'll be some things in your area that you can get involved in too. Okay, we'll leave it there. Oh, class is done by donation. Please give lots of donations. Be as generous as you can be. And know that that generosity is part of the practice, part of breaking our self-centeredness and our clinging and our, and it's intentional that we don't set a fee for class. Several levels of that intention. One is to not exclude anybody who can't afford it so that everyone's welcome and there's no price barrier. And one is to actually give you the option, the opportunity to practice generosity, freely offering rather than paying for service. So use that as part of your practice and give what feels appropriate to you. May any goodness that come from our practice be shared outward in all directions with all beings and in existence. May each one of us get as free as possible in this lifetime. And together may we create a positive change on this planet. Thank you. Good to see everybody. I forgot to ring the bell, but we'll just pretend like it rang. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.